hymn to sing, and thank you for singing with such good voice this afternoon. Martin's going to speak to us.
Thank you, Tony, and thank you indeed for singing fine hymns which have stood the test of time and which express a great deal about what we believe. And I love that hymn because it tells us there are many things we cannot tell and do not know. Just before we look at that, just let me thank also again those who've been involved in the activities this week and encourage you please to pray for all kinds of activities and ministries for older people. Maybe on the point of retirement, it's appropriate that I think about that and mention that. But I had an email just a couple of weeks ago from somebody at another church asking what we were doing for older people and talking about other churches and what they do. And it's an important area for all of us. Those of us who are getting older or spending time with older people, we're aware of the various needs that come with increasing age and the different kind of provision that we need to make. And can I please encourage you to pray for the work at Dorothea Court? It's a very special place for many people, some of you here. It's your home. And one of the things that I am hoping to do in the next little while is to spend more time, get a little bit more involved in what happens there. And the Pilgrim Friends Society nationally supports that and other homes and housing schemes as well. So as we come to the end of this summer days, as we call it, let's remember not only one another here, but those who perhaps we know who are in much greater need than we are. On Friday, a number of us went up to Castle Ashby, and on the drive in, I was told, and certainly for me on the drive out, we couldn't help notice the sheep, and there were hundreds of them, and they were wandering about in the grounds, and some of them spend most of the day, it seems, nibbling at the grass, and all good for them, I'm sure. I can't think of anything less interesting than spending all day in a field eating grass, but then I'm not a sheep, and it wouldn't be a very wise thing to do. The sheep that we saw as we drove away, I forget who was in the car with me, but they were on the road, they were in the way, and they moved very slowly. And I didn't sound my horn, I was very gentle and kind to them, sort of moving up towards them, and eventually they look round and they see there's something there, and they move slowly out of the way. I don't know what your view of sheep is. It does depend on which part of the country you come from, where you've grown up, what your lifestyle has been. But I know that there are many places where sheep are regarded as needing a lot of help and a lot of care. And I guess that's the reason why Jesus chooses to use this picture. It's not the only reason. It's maybe not the most important reason. But it would have been a very obvious picture to use for the people in the land of Israel and Palestine, as we know of it, and for the people who were listening to his teaching here, recorded in John chapter 10. Pictures of people and life are very important. We had one last week, didn't we? I was speaking from Hebrews 12 about the Christian life as a journey, as a race that we travel on, and God uses that picture frequently, and we need to fix our eyes on Jesus, on the destination, but not just a place, but a person. And Jesus chooses to use this picture here, and as we've seen from our hymns and readings, it's a very common picture in the Bible. And these two pictures, the race and the sheep, don't perhaps go together, but they're both pictures that would be good for us to keep in our minds as we go through our Christian lives. And I want us to spend a few minutes this afternoon thinking about what Jesus says, particularly in verses 11 to 18. But you're probably familiar with the whole chapter, John chapter 10. If you ever wonder what it means to be a Christian, read John chapter 10. It's very personal. It's very much about Jesus, very much about us as his followers, his disciples. But it's a chapter that I think many of you will have found very helpful. And I know not many of you here are likely to be preachers. Perhaps some of you will speak to others. I hope you will. about Jesus. But Jesus finds himself here amongst a rather hostile audience. If you look at the beginning of chapter 10, Jesus is actually speaking to the Pharisees in verse 1. "Very truly, I tell you, Pharisees." In other words, he's speaking to people who thought they knew a lot more about the subject than he did. He was a rabbi, he taught, he had followers, but here were the Pharisees who lived a very good way of life, upright, righteous, keeping the law. They thought they were the special ones, the holy ones almost, certainly separated from sinners. And he addresses them and he challenges them. And it would be worth us realizing that this whole chapter is addressed to very religious people. And that's what you are. And that's what I am. You might not think that. You don't want to be called religious. You want to be called Christian. I understand that. But the world out there thinks we're very religious. We try to live a good life. We go to church. We read the Bible, we say our prayers, we sing hymns, we do all those religious things. Sometimes we have special meetings, we have baptisms, we pray, we do all kinds of things. We share in communion as we did this morning. We're very religious people. Well, there's a danger, perhaps not too great here this afternoon, but there's certainly a danger in general that when we talk to religious people, we will be easily misunderstood. If you look at what's happened before the passage we're looking at, in verse 6, we're told that Jesus used this figure of speech, talking about the sheep, but the Pharisees did not understand what he was telling them. So if you go around saying to people, "Well, I'm following Jesus, he's like the shepherd and I'm the sheep," they might think, "Well, do you really know what you're talking about? What a strange idea that we're sheep. And that we're like those animals that can't get out of the way of the car and that wander about all day eating grass. Surely that's not a very dignified, respectful way to speak about us." Well, Jesus chooses to describe us as sheep. He is the shepherd and we are the sheep. Of course, if you're Jesus, which we're not, and we're not ever going to be able to say the things that he says in places in this passage, you will get into serious trouble. If you just look on a little bit, towards the end of the chapter, after the passage that we've heard read to say today, you see in verse 19, the Jews who heard these words were again divided. Many of them said, "He's demon-possessed and raving mad. Why listen to him?" It might not seem like a compliment, but in a way it was to Jesus. They didn't understand what he said and they didn't like it. And you know why? Later on, you find in verse 29, he talks in a personal way about his father. "My father who has given them to me," that's the sheep, "is greater than all. No one can snatch them out of my father's hand. I and the father are one." And at that point, he'd crossed a line. He'd claimed to be equal with God and they picked up stones to stone him. Well, he manages to defuse that situation and he responds to them. But we just need to recognize that some of the things Jesus says and some of the things that we say, speaking on his behalf, will not go down well with religious people. And certainly today, we live in a multi-faith, multi-religious society. And if you say, as Jesus says, "No one comes to the Father, to God, except through me," you will not be popular. If you say, as the early Christians said, that there is no other name given under heaven by which we must be saved, you will not be very popular. And if you say to religious people, as Jesus does here, that there are people who are false shepherds, there are people who don't come, he says, by the gate, but they climb in by another way. They're thieves and they're robbers. So it's a very comforting picture for those of us who say, yes, we're sheep and we're followers of the good shepherd. But it's also a picture that might end us up in trouble if we're not careful. And the reason that it might do that is the first thing that I want to say to you from this passage. And that is that the whole picture here presupposes that we are in spiritual danger and we need protection. Just look at verse 11, if you will. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. So Jesus is talking about a shepherd being in mortal danger. What's the problem? Verse 12. The hired hand, the one who's just been brought in and he's only doing it for the money, he's not the shepherd. He does not own the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. The wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he's a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. So we are in spiritual danger. This is not a picture about sheep. It's not farming advice. This is truly important for us because it's about spiritual life. And really all the pictures Jesus uses are about our spiritual life. That is the life of the soul, if you will, which lasts beyond death. We're so taken up, aren't we, in our culture, certainly in the West, with our physical well-being, with our housing, with education, with health, with all those things that we see around us. There's nothing wrong with that. That's absolutely right. God is concerned about all those things. Give us today our daily bread. We need to pray for those things and provide and care for people. But Jesus is concerned about something much deeper and much more lasting. He's concerned about spiritual danger. So who is the wolf? Well, very simply, the wolf represents all those who are against God. And those who are against God, if we're Christians, if we're following his way, are against us also. Now, I've just mentioned three things there. They're big words, and we could spend a lot of time giving examples and applying. But the sin that's in my life, my wrong attitude to you and yours to me and to other people and to God, and my self-indulgence of things that I know are not good and healthy, but I like them, or whatever it might be, that is spiritually dangerous. If we live with our sin and do nothing with it, Jesus says we're on that broad road that leads to destruction. But there isn't just sin in my life and in yours. There's evil outside of us trying to trip us up. That's the devil and all his forces at work. And Jesus is aware of that. And what's called in the Bible the last enemy is very much in view in Jesus' thinking, death itself. And again, let's be honest with one another. Many of us here are not young. Now, death doesn't come only to older people. It comes to young people as well. It's one of the tragedies and the struggles that we have in life. When younger people die, it feels unnatural. It feels so wrong. But many of us here are older. We've just had in the notice sheet today, dear Esther White, who passed away earlier in the week. One day it will come. And that's a spiritual danger, because we need to know what happens after that. Jesus, of all people, we should listen to. What age did he die? 33. Young man in the prime of life, and he knew that death awaited. So this is serious. We're in spiritual danger. But here's the good news. Only Jesus loves us enough to lay down his life. I am the good shepherd. So not any character in the Bible. We have that song we sing sometimes, Jesus is greater than the greatest heroes. It's no good Abraham or David or Moses or any of those people laying down their lives. If any of us here say, I'll sacrifice my life for this whole congregation here this afternoon, it won't do a single bit of good spiritually. But Jesus, who is good and pleased his Father completely, when he says he's the good shepherd, he goes on to say that he'll lay down his life for the sheep. And what I want to say is this, his death was, I would say, spiritually powerful enough. It wasn't a powerful death, was it? It was a shameful death. It was a painful death. It was a death which seemed not just a disappointment, it seemed a disaster to the followers and to the crowds who had only a little while before been following in thousands and listening to him and seeing his miracles. Why would this amazing ministry and this remarkable life end in such a shameful way? It wasn't a quick death. It wasn't a painless death. It was the worst kind of death you could almost imagine. Certainly in that day, it was the worst way to die. But it was spiritually powerful. It was the most amazing death, the most amazing final breath that you could ever have. Why? Because he was a truly good man. Since Adam sinned, Since Adam and Eve broke God's commands in the Garden of Eden, there has never been a perfect human being on the face of the earth, nor will they be apart from Jesus. So only his life doesn't deserve to end in death. The wages of sin is death. The rest of us, Adam and Eve onwards, including the greatest men and women who you could possibly imagine, Bible, history, today, future, whoever they might be, none of them will have the spiritual power to help us defeat sin and the powers of evil. And that's what he tells us here. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. No one else loves us enough to do it. No one else is committed enough. No one else is good enough. That other hymn, we could have sung that today. There was no other good enough to pay the price of sin. He only could unlock the gate of heaven and let us in. And you look on to verse 17, a fascinating insight into the relationship between Jesus and his Father. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life. Isn't that good? The Father loves the Son because he knows that the Son loves us enough to give up his life. He knows that his Son, Jesus, is the most selfless person you could imagine. And he's willing to sacrifice himself for those he loves. And again, we could say more, and it's almost just a summary here, even in Jesus' teaching. And when you think of the way the early Christians spoke about the cross, about the death of Jesus, they talked about all those powers of evil being defeated there, things being nailed to the cross, Satan himself being defeated in principle by the death of this good man. And remember, Satan didn't want Jesus to go to the cross. Sometimes we think Satan caused Jesus to go. That's completely wrong. It was God who wanted Jesus to die. Satan tried to stop him. Remember that? In the Garden of Eden, in those temptations in the desert at the beginning of his ministry. You don't want to be like this. Why don't you just command the stone to be bread? Why don't you just bow down and worship me? Why don't you just test God? He'll look after you. And in the Garden of Eden, do you think that was in the Garden of Gethsemane? Do you think that was just Jesus struggling? The enemy was there in his head, as it were. You don't want to go through this. It's too hard. Why should you go through this? What have you done to deserve it? But Jesus says, not my will, but yours be done. And he resists every temptation to go some other way. And so when he dies, though he may not have realized at the time, the devil was truly and utterly defeated. And it was the most glorious moment, which is why we rightly call it Good Friday. So Jesus' death was powerful. But then let's think about us, because this passage really is about us. I mean, Jesus is speaking not only to Pharisees, he's speaking to his own disciples. They were there listening. He always spoke to mixed groups of people. But he's particularly focusing on those who thought that they were okay. And basically, he says here, the only way you can be okay is to trust in the Good Shepherd, because the Good Shepherd is the one who's laid down his life for you. And that's what you need. You need a good death. You need somebody who is the spotless Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world. You need him to lay down his life. And so then there's a beginning of a choice. And that's what verse 14 is about. I'm the Good Shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. Immediately, the Pharisees would have been a bit put out. Were they his sheep or were they not? Who is he talking about? Is he making a distinction between some people who will be okay and some people who won't? Yes, he is. And if you go on again, it's not in our passage, and you know it, and it's worth you reading it maybe another time during this coming week. Look at verse 27. My sheep listen to my voice. I know them and they follow me. And again and again, Jesus finds himself saying things which will divide his hearers. If you just look in the verse before, this is very outspoken. Verse 26, you do not believe because you are not my sheep. In other words, he speaks to them, and the fact that they reject his word tells him what's in their hearts. They're not his sheep. They don't listen to his voice. What we need to realize is that to be his sheep, to be sure that we are, we need to listen to what he says. And listening to what he says is what he means by following him and knowing him. You see how those things go together. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. And knowing him is because we listen to his voice. Look in verse 16. I have other sheep, not of this sheepfold. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice. There shall be one flock and there shall be one shepherd. In fact, that's the picture he's been using before. He has a picture at the beginning about him being the gatekeeper to the fold. The gatekeeper, verse 3, opens the gate for him. The sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and he leads them out. They recognize his voice. And if you're here this afternoon and you recognize the voice of Jesus in the scriptures, as you read it, as you hear it spoken about, if you respond to that, that's a sign that God is at work in your heart. One of the ways we need to distinguish between those who are spiritually alive and those who are not is spiritually alive people will hear the word of God. They will want to hear it. They will listen. They will say, this is God's voice. I need to hear it. I need to follow that. And sometimes we speak, and Jesus did it, and the Apostle Paul did it, and he speaks to great crowds of people. And some listen and some don't. What was it that Jesus somehow wasn't as persuasive as he should have been? No, the difference was in people's hearts. That in their hearts they were stubborn and resisting what Jesus had said. And here he speaks and he urges us to listen to his voice and to follow him and to know him. And then fourthly and finally, here is the most amazing thing, I suppose. I mentioned those three big words, sin, evil, and death, things that are our enemies. They're with us all the time. Death is something that we understandably draw back from. Many people live in fear of death, and that's a very natural thing to do. But even we who are Christians, who say that we know what's beyond the grave, we don't know what the future will hold. And when we see others passing from this life, we are concerned rightly about ourselves. But Jesus says here that he has defeated that. Look at verse 18. No one takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. This command I have received from my Father. And that is the heart of the gospel, isn't it? It's not about shepherds and sheep. It's about the life and death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus. He died and rose from the dead and ascended to heaven. And, you know, it's so easy for us, isn't it, to spend our lives thinking about our own lives, about church life, about work, about family, all those things. That's all got its place. But we need to realize the greatest event, the event that God, in a sense, will assess and judge us by, that we need to be thinking about is the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. What we think of Jesus, what we make of him, that's God's test. We might say, well, that doesn't seem fair. Couldn't God take into account this that I've done or that? Well, of course he could. But the point is, our lives are never going to impress God, however hard we try. They're never going to please him fully. But Jesus' life did. And if we're wise, we shelter, as we say, under the cross. We put our lives in his hands and we know that he will speak on our behalf at that last day. Well, let me draw some thoughts to a close here. Jesus is alive today. That's what the resurrection means. It doesn't mean simply that he rose and defeated death. He is alive today. He ascended to heaven. One day he will return. We were hearing about that this morning, some of us who were here. That's one of the big central truths of the New Testament, that Jesus will return. Now, you might not believe that. You say, oh, it hasn't happened. When is it going to happen? How do I know? What's the proof? Well, that's your choice. The evidence is here that if Jesus rose from the dead, if God raised him supernaturally, that to me is enough evidence. If that's true, then the other things that Jesus says are true. And one of the things he says again and again and again is that he will return and that we will see him coming, not as a baby, but in power and in glory. So he calls us to follow him. And the question there is whether you will respond to his voice. And that's what he has talked about already. Verse 7, very truly I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. Verse 9, I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. And can I say, sometimes as Christians we talk about being saved and we talk about what we're saved from much more than what we're saved for. And that can sound very negative. I understand that. It's right to speak about judgment. It was very helpful to hear that from Tom from 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. There's a powerful message there in judgment. We're saved from the consequences of our sin. We're saved from the guilt of our sin. We're saved now, starting now, from the power of sin in our lives. We're saved from the power of evil. We're saved ultimately from that last enemy of death. All of that is what we're delivered from. But what for? Just so we can say, whew, I'm safe. It's much, much more than that. Look at what Jesus says. Verse 9, I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. What does that mean, Jesus? They will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they might have life, and life to the full. Abundant life, overflowing life. And you can experience that in measure now. But it's only a foretaste of what is to come. And as we respond to his voice, there's much, much more that lies ahead. I'd like to finish, if I may, with reading you something from the end, the very end of Pilgrim's Progress. It's a very appropriate thing always to do in Bedford, but let me do that just as we finish this afternoon. You know the story, and there's part one with Christian, the pilgrim, and part two, his wife Christiana. And at the end of part two, there are various characters who come to the river. I think we were singing that last week, weren't we? That guide me, O thou great Jehovah, when I tread the verge of Jordan. And Bunyan has that picture of the river, and everybody comes to the river. It's the river of death, but beyond the river is the celestial city. Some of you will know the account of the passing over of Valiant for Truth, which is often quoted, and rightly so, at funeral services. I've heard it quoted and many other times. But I want to just read you about Mr. Standfast. I love that name, Mr. Standfast. That's what he's known for. He's just solid, steady. He stands his ground. He doesn't give way. And this is how John Bunyan ends the second part. I won't read it all for you, but just Mr. Standfast passing. Here it is. When Mr. Standfast had thus set things in order, and the time being come for him to haste him away, he also went down to the river. Now there was a great calm at that time in the river, wherefore Mr. Standfast, when he was about halfway in, stood a while and talked to his companions that had waited upon him thither, and said, this river has been a terror to many. Yea, the thoughts of it also have frightened me. But now methinks I stand easy. My foot is fixed upon that upon which the feet of the priests that bear the Ark of the Covenant stood while Israel went over this Jordan. The waters indeed are to the palate bitter and to the stomach cold. Yet the thoughts of what I am going to and of the conduct that waits for me on the other side doth lie as a glowing coal at my heart. I see myself now at the end of my journey. My toilsome days are ended. I'm going now to see that head that was crowned with thorns and that face that was spat upon for me. I have formerly lived by hearsay and faith, but now I go where I shall live by sight, and shall be with him in whose company I delight myself. I have loved to hear my Lord spoken of. Wherever I have seen the print of his shoe in the earth, there I have coveted to set my foot to. His name has been to me sweeter than all perfumes. His voice has been to me most sweet, and his countenance I have more desired than they that have most desired the light of the sun. His word I did use to gather for my food and for antidotes against my faintings. He has held me, and I have kept me from mine iniquities. Yea, my steps hath he strengthened in his way. Now while he was thus in discourse, his countenance changed. His strong man bowed under him. And after he had said, take me, for I come unto thee, he ceased to be seen of them. But glorious it was to see how the open region was filled with horses and chariots, with trumpeters and pipers, with singers and players on stringed instruments, to welcome the pilgrims as they went up and followed one another in at the beautiful gate of the city. That's where Bunyan knew that he was headed, where his pilgrim were headed, and it's where we're headed if we're following Jesus and hearing his voice, life and life to the full.